If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. You might know Bobby Finger from his two earlier novels, The Old Place or Four Squares, or maybe you follow his podcast, Who Weekly, where he and his co-host Lindsay Weber keep track of celebrities so you don't have to. His latest novel is We Are Gathered Here Today, where he returns to Texas for a look at marriage, gay, straight, or whatever. Bobby, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, so I was reading that you came upon the idea for this latest book, We Are Gathered Here Today, after visiting a cemetery in your hometown. Is that true?
Yes. I mean, there were a couple of things that caused this book to be created. And one of them was a wedding, The Hour of Disrespect, which is kind of a constant sort of flashback in the novel. The other thing was I'm from a very teeny tiny town outside of San Antonio. And I went there with my husband a couple of years ago, because we've been together for a very long time, but he'd never been to the town where I am from. And so my parents and I and my husband drove there. It's about an hour and a half from San Antonio one day. And we saw the house where I grew up, and we stopped in the cemetery. And, you know, we saw the graves of my grandparents and some family members. And my dad is over 80, and he grew up there. And so I was pointing out all these people, and I was like, who was this person? Who was this person? I don't remember this person. And there was a finger, and my last name is Finger, a finger that I'd never heard of among the other family members. And it was a name, a Clements Finger. And I'd never heard anyone talk about this person before. And he was one of the only fingers that didn't have a spouse next to him. He was buried alone, lifelong bachelor. And I asked if my dad knew him. And my dad was kind of like, yeah, he was kind of a character. He was weird. And there were all these sort of like euphemisms. I have no idea whether or not he was a gay man, whether or not he was queer. I just know that he was kind of a town weirdo, and his gravestone said beloved sage, poet, and wit. And I just thought, this guy is so interesting. I've never heard of him before. And I originally kind of wanted to explore what this person's story was. Like, what could happen if you discovered this long lost family member who might in some way explain your life? And he's not really a character in the novel, but there is a scene at a cemetery where someone, you know, looks back on a long lost distant family member that they didn't know about, and kind of comes to the understanding that he was a happy gay person in the middle of the century in this small town in Texas. And it's a minor part of the book, but I feel like it has a lot to do with the discovery of the truth of one's past, even if you have like a lot of assumptions about what the truth actually is.
And I think I read somewhere where you said he's the only real character, real person to make the book.
Yes.
You also said, and I wanted to get to the story, obviously, but in another interview, that the book that came out was very different from the one you conceived. Did you just sort of reveal the one you conceived there, where it was going to be more about him?
It was going to be a little more about him. The book was primarily different structurally. It was framed as kind of not a murder mystery, but it was bookended with a death. So originally someone was going to die at this wedding, and it began at the end, and then you sort of flashback and you wonder who was going to die. And that's what the first draft was. And I remember my editor saying, you know, I like this. I like it a lot. It doesn't need death. There's a lot of death in my first two novels. And she said, what about this one? This one can just be a fun summer wedding book. Can we just remove the death?
It sounds like White Lotus at a wedding.
Yes. Yes. Without the rich people, but yes. And it was a smart note, because it allowed me to kind of explore the themes of marriage that I wanted to without getting distracted by who's going to die. And ultimately, the character there was a character who maybe you could guess was going to be the death, and they survived. And there's some breadcrumbs, I guess, because not everything changed. And so I think a lot of people read it thinking, oh, I hope this one particular character doesn't die. I'm worried you're going to kill them off. And I don't. But originally, I did. The book just didn't need it.
Overall, I guess the idea, the theme is you is gay marriage. And why is it that gay people are now in such a rush to do something to join an institution, to take part in a tradition that they were so long kept out of. What did you discover?
Right. I guess what I discovered was, as a gay person who is married myself, I've been married for almost 8 years at this point, and I have a complicated relationship with it, because, I mean, I love being married, I love my husband, but I never imagined myself as being married, primarily because it couldn't happen. It was illegal. And it wasn't something that I was incredibly depressed about. Like, it was like, do I really feel any sort of resentment towards an institution that doesn't want me in it? You know? So it wasn't like I was upset that I couldn't be involved, but there was a sort of maybe a vague melancholy to it. And then when it was legalized and I was able to get married, it was something I kind of had to have a long, hard think about. Do I really want this? Is this, even if I do want this, is this right of me to join this sort of, as I said, this institution that only recently let me into its club?
Well, I'm not alone in that. It's a form of conformity, right? It's joining into conformity.
And that's why, you know, so much of it, I'm not sure if it's more in the kind of press materials for it, but the queer table that the characters are at, it's like that word is so important. It's like something that, yes, it's true to your identity. You are queer, but also it's a point of pride to be a little different than everyone else. It's different than the status quo. And if you succumb to the pressures of what the straight people are doing, does that ruin a little bit of your own personality? Like, do you lose something by agreeing to join in on these people, even if it's something that you really want? And that's a struggle that the main character, Finn, is going through in this novel. And ultimately, he figures out an answer to it. But as he is discussing it with other people at the table, he's realizing that he's not alone in this hesitation. And some people don't care. Some people care a lot. Some people want nothing to do with it. Some people are happy to be included. And I think the answer is whatever works for you is the right answer.
Yeah, Finn says at one point that it's become so normal that it's actually a little bit lame now.
Yes.
Let's talk about Finn. You write that he is a person with a life of unfulfilled notebooks. Tell me about that.
Finn is someone who is a kind of unwitting, accidental food influencer. He had originally in an early draft, he had kind of an interesting, very boring office corporate job. His job had nothing to do with the character at all. I didn't want to think about it because his job didn't matter. And I slowly decided that I wanted him to be a food influencer, not because it's incredibly crucial to the plot, but it just shows that he fell into something and didn't really think about it and didn't care. It's something he's not passionate about, even though, you know, it works. Mm-hmm. It's something that people kind of understand in this day and age. And he did it a little thoughtlessly. And it's something that may not be one of his aspirations, but he's just doing it because. And so there is sort of
that's marriage.
Yes. So in some ways, right? Like, he's worried that that's going to be marriage for him, right? Because this other giant part of his life is something that he came into rather thoughtlessly, and he doesn't want to fall into that same trap, right? Yeah. Even if it's successful, even if it's fruitful, he doesn't want to do something that he doesn't feel passionate for. And because he's constantly in his head, he can't really make that decision as to whether or not marriage is for him. And that's what it takes the entire weekend and the book for him to figure out.
That's interesting you say that he's constantly in his head, because he and I do this, I think a lot of people do. We create these stories, we catastrophize, mm-hmm. right, about what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And he does that over and over, and it ends up sometimes maybe having too much influence on his decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's the whole point of the Hour of Disrespect, too, to showcase he has been to so many weddings in his young adult life that he spent so much time scrutinizing the weddings of other people, the marriages of other people, and it allows himself to get stuck in his own head when it comes to his own marriage and his own engagement. And that's why he wants to keep it a secret from the people that he's with over the course of that weekend.
You mentioned a couple times the Hour of Disrespect. We should explain that. And this is something you really do.
Mm-hmm. I really do it. Yeah.
Okay. So after a wedding, you get together with your friends, and no complaining during the ceremony, no complaining mm-hmm. during the reception about the food or the music, but then mm-hmm. afterward, you and your company 1 hour mm-hmm. to just rip it apart.
Yeah, it began. I now that I'm having to speak about this book publicly a lot, I'm trying to dance around the origin story because sure, I don't want to be cruel. Because it truly, the origin of The Hour of Disrespect came from a wedding that was a tough sit for reasons that had nothing to do with the central couple. I want to be very clear about that. It was just a wedding where a lot of things went wrong. A lot of people who were ancillary to the actual couple made some fusses, and it was an often unpleasant experience. And so after the event, and I was with some friends, we were sort of shell-shocked. Like, we couldn't believe what we had just experienced over the course of this entire day. And I could just tell that we were ready to rip into it. And we still had a few days left to hang out as friends. And I suggested, why don't we just complain about it now before we go to bed? We give ourselves an hour, and then we don't talk about it again for the rest of the weekend because we don't want to let it sour the mood. And I think the hope for The Hour of Disrespect is that you keep it siloed for that hour and then you don't discuss it again. But that's really not the reality. Sometimes it comes up. You have something to complain about a few hours later. But it makes you a little more thoughtful about the way that you discuss it in the future.
So what would have come up at The Hour of Disrespect after your wedding?
It's not for me. It's not for me to decide. I know that people definitely had it because the people who helped originate The Hour of Disrespect were at my own wedding. And I found myself kind of thinking about it as a joke. Oh, I wonder what they're going to say.
Right, right.
And I think it's healthier not to think about it because The Hour of Disrespect isn't for the couple at the center of it. It's for everyone else. So I'm supposed to not think about it. It's not supposed to matter.
So you're getting married. You created this. Mm-hmm. Your friends are there with whom you share this ritual. And you know they're going to do it about you.
Yes.
That's torture.
And it's torture in a way, but I think maybe I try to think about it not being torture, right? Because it's so universal, because everyone can experience it, then it shouldn't feel personal. It shouldn't feel like some sort of piercing thing, because I know that it's happening for everyone and that it has nothing to do with me. It has everything to do with the ritual of it, right? Because it's not about me and my husband. It's about the friends who were there trying to make the best of a situation that they may not have thought was perfect. And I know the wedding wasn't perfect, but to me, I think it was great. I can't imagine what they said, but I know they said something.
I'm sure it was fantastic, Bobby. The other couples there at the gay table, David and Todd, represent a couple having trouble. Elaine, who's marrying, his name escapes me now.
Rupert.
Rupert, Finn's cousin, Elaine, that's the wedding, marrying Rupert. So you've got that model. And then you've got Jackie, who's another good friend of Finn's, sort of maybe finding her way toward a relationship. Mm-hmm. And so all of these characters, as you said, are sort of examining the institution of marriage, how it fits for them. And what I took away from it is that, well, let me do this. Finn said at one point that every straight marriage is a little gay and every gay marriage is a little straight. Mm-hmm. What was he talking about there?
He was talking about the fact that every straight marriage, despite what I think a lot of popular culture and just culture in general would have you believe, is that every marriage follows the same set of rules. Once you enter into this institution, everyone's doing it the same way, even though I think intellectually you know that that's not the case. Every marriage is a little bit off-center. It's different. Every marriage is a little gay, even though we'd like to believe that these straight people who got married are following the exact same rules. You know, like everyone is doing the exact same thing. We know it's not true, but I think it's a lie we sometimes have to tell ourselves to understand why you would get into a marriage to begin with. And every gay marriage, even though it is atypical and is very non-traditional in terms of these rules that have been around for so many generations, right? This is how marriage is between a man and a woman, and that's it. It's gay by its very nature of it being a same-sex couple, right? Because same-sex marriage is legal now. But it's straight in that you are in this club that was extremely restrictive for a very long time, and you've chosen to join it anyway. You've chosen to do this extremely, to use the word heteronormative thing, you know?
It was restrictive, and yet it wasn't. I mean, you know, you could be 16 in a terrible relationship, but forced to get married. Things like that. But in the end, it seems to me like what I took from this is that couples are couples, mm-hmm. and marriages are marriages, right? In the end, we all sort of share the same joys and tribulations, and that's kind of, is that what you were trying to tell me?
Yes, and I'm glad that's what you took from it. And I think it's not the most profound lesson that he learns, but it's a lesson that he needed to finally understand. It's the marriage that he enters in with his fiance is his marriage and his marriage alone, right? It's for the two of them. It's for nobody else. And I think that that is something that is obvious to people, but it's also quite easy to ignore. You get caught up in the pomp and circumstance of it all, and your history and your memory of weddings and marriages of people that you know that didn't work out, and you worry that it's going to happen to you too, and ultimately it might.
Lindholm Roofing has appointments available now to provide you a complete roofing, siding, gutter, and tuck pointing inspection. Call 773-283-7675 or lindholmroofing.com. Tell them that Lou sent you. Lindholm Roofing, their family has your family covered.
But okay, you hope that it doesn't.
I have to admit something, and this is embarrassing to me, but I know I do a lousy job of picturing characters, right? And I was talking recently to, was it Lisa C or someone, and she said that she never pictures the characters as people. It was Tanya French. And I just feel like I need to confess to you that when I mark the fiance of Finn who comes in as a surprise, I got the view of Dr. Oz in my head.
That works.
How did that? But it didn't fit the description at all, and I couldn't shake it.
No, I mean, to me, whatever works for you to help you actually have a richer experience of them in your mind, I think that's fine. I really like envisioning and picturing characters when I read the books of other people, mm-hmm. but I have a very hard time doing it for my own.
No kidding.
People ask me, because I'm great at, you know, fantasy casting a novel that I'm reading, always. Like, I think of the celebrity who it's going to be. I don't know if that's bad behavior or good behavior, but it helps me enjoy the novel a little bit more. I'm lousy at doing it for myself. And people ask me all the time, who would be Mary Alice in the Old Place, my first novel? Who would be Finn in this? And I never have an answer. I just Maybe I'm too close to it, perhaps. I don't know.
Well, there's also this whole idea that books are equations, right? And you, it's not, you don't get the equal sign until the reader reads it and interprets it. So leave that part for the reader.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's one of the greatest things about books too. Just it's yours now. And it's hard to sort of get to that point, but I feel like I have finally gotten to that point where I'm okay just releasing it and having them do what they want with it. Cause that's the whole point, you know?
So you go back, two of your books are set in your hometown, essentially. It's a different name. Mm-hmm. What was it like as a gay kid growing up there? And has it changed?
I don't know if it's changed.
Let me say this, Bobby, because I have a gay daughter and I have a transgender daughter. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they'd feel comfortable in small town Texas.
Yeah, and I think they would be right to feel uncomfortable in a small town in Texas, honestly. And writing The Old Place specifically was, it was less of a reflection of the reality of me growing up there, because we moved when I was in my teenage years. We moved to San Antonio when I was in high school.
Okay.
Eighth grade. So I'm grateful for that. Because I think it would have been tough had I been in my high school years there, in classes of, 13 people, not all of whom are the most open and friendly people in the world. And I'm happy that I was able to go to a city where I could be a little bit more comfortable with myself and figure out who I was a little more freely. But part of the exercise in writing The Old Place, even though it has very little to do with my own personal life, was me exploring what my life may have been like had I stayed.
I see, right.
Had I lived the entirety of my teenage years in that town, what could have happened? And what happens to the character in that novel is not entirely positive.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I want it to be both honest about small towns in Texas and perhaps small towns anywhere that you can't really romanticize them too much. It might be difficult for people. It is very difficult for people. It still is. But I wanted to provide a little hope for people who cannot leave. And so ultimately that novel shows that this town that she thought was quite repressive and was going to hate her, and Michael, the character, they thought this town was going to hate him, they ultimately do accept him with relatively open arms. And maybe that is not what would have happened for everyone in that situation, but I wanted to allow myself to hope that it could.
Talking to Bobby Finger, the name of his book is We're Gathered Here Today. He's also the co-host of a podcast called Who Weekly. How did that come about? And just tell me the genesis of it and how it's gotten so big.
The podcast.
Yeah.
It came about as a hobby for one of my best friend. We were both writers for websites. We both worked in advertising. We'd known each other for a while. And we were always kind of on, we love to try everything once, you know, as new social media platforms would pop up, as new trends would happen on the internet, we love to give them a shot and see if something stuck. Newsletters, Tumblr, Twitter, Instagram, like we would try all of these things mm-hmm. and anything that was trendy. And for a while, newsletters were quite trendy. This was in the mid 2010s. And we started a newsletter about something that we thought was funny, which was D-list celebrities, which we named Who's. Who's and Them's, we gave it a binary. The Them's are the very famous people. The Who's are the less famous people who you don't quite recognize when you see them on the cover of a magazine or on a headline. And it was a newsletter for a while, called it Who Weekly. And then podcasts became kind of popular again with the advent of Serial and things like that. And we decided to give it a run as a podcast, fully thinking that we would abandon it after a couple of weeks. But it stuck. It got a small audience that was interested. We had some good press early. And it, over the course of a few years, it went from something that we made no money on, that we just did for fun, kind of for our friends, to something that we made a little bit of money on. And so we could do it part-time. We could have part-time jobs and then do the podcast, to the thing that's ultimately the bulk of our lives. And it took 10 years to get to that point, but it got to that point, and it's a lot of fun.
Do you consider, would you, on your card, would it be say author or would it say podcast host?
The thing is, I might need two sets of cards. I think it would say podcast host first because I've been doing that longer, but I would definitely make another stack depending on who I was giving it to that said author.
So also I heard that we have you to thank for a lot of the VH1 copy that we heard.
One of my first jobs after moving to New York, because I moved from Texas in 2009, was working for an advertising agency, and that didn't last very long. It didn't last as long as I'd hoped it would last, but I did get a job at Viacom, working for mostly VH1, but a couple other networks as well, writing copy for all of their shows. And it was just a wacky, fun experience. It was extremely busy all of the time. VH1 had 1 billion shows. They were constantly getting canceled or renewed, or there were new ones. And so there was always a new strange show that I probably didn't watch much of to write for. And it was just a very fun environment. And I'm very glad I had the chance to work there for as long as I did, because it was absurd, but it was also less intense than a normal. It was busy. I felt very creative. I felt like I was having a good time. Quite thankful to have such a cool job, and also not to be working in an actual advertising agency, which is what much more cutthroat, which is where I went after VH1 and I regretted leaving. It was a horrible experience. It was just a nastier, meaner, more unpleasant environment. And VH1 was the ideal job for, I think, a recent advertising graduate who just wanted to copyright somewhere.
Listen, I'm glad you write as novels as well. I really enjoyed We Are Gathered Here Today. It's a funny story. It's a poignant story. It's a universal story, obviously, right? I mean, we all go through these weddings. Many of us get married. We all have an elder relative who turns out to be the sage in many mm-hmm. ways. A great read, and I can't wait to see what's next from you, Bobby.
Thanks so much for having me. I can't wait either.
What, you got something in the pipeline?
Yeah, but we'll see. It's early days yet, so.
Well, I like to hear authors tell me all about it in the early days because I know they like to discuss it.
Yeah, it's another novel. If it pans out the way I'd like it to pan out, it's another novel about friendship of two gay men. There is a murder involved. Essentially, it is the recounting of a friendship between two best friends over many decades of their life that tragically ends in the death of one of them. Mm. But it's sort of recounting that friendship before its sad ending.
All right, I wish you
luck. But it's funny. I hope it's funny.
I'm sure it'll be funny. Bobby Finger. It was great to talk to you, Bobby.
It was great to talk to you, too.
You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. I'm glad you are. I hope you'll follow me. You know, you can subscribe at Apple or Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. It's carried as well at WGNradio.com. Or drop me an email, stevebertrandonbooks@gmail.com. All right, that's it this week. We'll talk to you next week.